DW Deutsche Welle Spectrum.
Hello and welcome to Spectrum on DW, deep and dirty in the worlds of science and technology as ever. I'm Zulfikar Abani, and coming up, waking up dormant HIV cells 30 years after the virus was first detected, and the low-cost rotavirus vaccine that could save hundreds of thousands of lives and start a homegrown pharma industry in India.
It has given us tremendous experience through this global partnership to learn how to do these things from discovery to the end product. We have science which is good. We have a generic industry which is good. Not often had the privilege of trying to cover the whole value chain. And this, with the help of some wonderful global partners, was possible to achieve.
All that and more right here on Spectrum. But first, the microblogging site Twitter says it will introduce an optional two-step login to make it more secure for users, following some pretty high-profile breaches, one of which resulted in the Dow Jones Industrial Average losing more than 100 points. That's money to you and me. That was after a Twitter account run by the news agency Associated Press, or AP, was hacked. Now, the hackers sent out a tweet saying there had been two explosions at the White House in Washington, and that one of them had either injured or killed Barack Obama. Obama had not been injured, but in the minutes that it took to work out the truth, some people had lost loads of money and others had made a killing, financially speaking. Some blamed social media and others blamed high-frequency trading, an automated form of trading that's dictated by the algorithms that underpin it. Chiponda Chimbelu has been to the Frankfurt Stock Exchange to find out the role that technology and social media are playing in the financial markets and how security breaches can be avoided.
The Frankfurt Stock Exchange may be one of the world's largest stock exchanges, but with only about 36 people on the trading floor, it's hard to believe that millions of dollars are exchanging hands. Miroslav Budimir is an expert in cash market development with Deutsche Börse, the company that owns the Frankfurt Stock Exchange, and he explains why the place isn't bustling with people.
It's the same distribution as you have in the airline sector, where most of the airlines today employ autopilots, but also you have smaller planes flying still on the manual system and with eyesight. So it's the same here on the stock exchange.
And here's why.
For instance, there are so-called smart order routers who basically take away the decision from the human, and basically on a set of predefined criteria, they send an order where they think is best at that moment in order to get the best price.
Traders get their data on stocks and the best prices for stocks from different sources, including the news. News agencies like Bloomberg, Thomson Reuters, and Dow Jones Newswires break down news items into categories by company, sector, product, product launch, or any other event that could have an effect on a particular sector of business. At the same time, there are computers that are programmed with algorithms designed to look out for and react to these indicators. And depending on what the indicator is, it can trigger a massive reaction. This is the art of high frequency or machine-based trading. Louis Lovers from One Market Data explains.
For example, if a pharmaceutical company announces they got approval for a new drug or got rejected, that has huge implications on what happens to their stock, right? So if they get, if it's some well-publicized new drug for diabetes or something, and they get government-level approval to go ahead and market that drug, that has a direct impact. So if you can get a jump on that by looking at news feeds, well, then, you can get in the market to either go long or go short on that stock, depending on sort of the news announcement.
And what kind of a difference in terms of, like, how quick you are? Because, of course, it's competition between the news agencies, heavy competition, who's faster. And what kind of an edge is a second or 2 seconds in when you're talking about machine-based trading?
It's certainly a good deal faster than 1 or 2 seconds. It's more like on the order of something like news within, I'd say, 10 milliseconds. So it has to be enormously fast for somebody to get a jump on it.
But that can lead to problems.
I just paid 500 G's. The market didn't work. It broke down. The machines broke down. It's the greatest story never told. You'll never know what happened there.
We'll get back to you.
All right, Matt, thanks very much.
Never know what happened there. I couldn't really tell you.
In May 2010, the Dow Jones plunged 1,000 points, about 9% of its value, as a result of high-frequency trading systems selling aggressively amid the European debt crisis. But the most recent flash crash, sparked by a fake tweet, has finally got a lot of investors thinking about the system. The AP News Agency's Twitter feed was hacked in April. The hackers caused a big scare, suggesting the US president was injured or dead. And all of a sudden, and for just a brief moment, the markets went into overdrive.
The big story today, a shocking but fake tweet. That from the Associated Press, and it set off a steep stock market sell-off, and then just as...
The fake news was corrected in minutes, but the Dow Jones had already lost more than $136 billion, and all because traders had left the thinking to the machines. But Louis Lovers of One Market Data says the machines are not to blame for the crash.
I know the finger's been pointed directly at algorithmic trading, but... It's an arguable, debatable point whether that sort of initial reaction or that sell-off was initiated by human behavior or human emotional reaction or machines or possibly a combination of the two, which is probably the most likely candidate.
Perhaps this is not a simple question of who's to blame. That's why regulators in Europe have stopped short of calling for an outright ban on machine-based trading and are instead pushing for a speed limit. But before that happens, others are trying to figure out how and whether social media, like Twitter, should be integrated in their algorithms. Louis Lovers.
Use of that data, social media, for example, like from Twitter or news feeds, is really in its infancy. What I mean by it's in its infancy is that trading firms are still pretty suspect or suspicious about its value. And of course, this event that just happened with this Twitter hack is not going to help things. If anything, it's going to slow that progress for any firm contemplating the idea, potentially might even avoid it altogether.
While the traders try to work that one out, the day-to-day business of selling and buying goes on. There are measures at Frankfurt to prevent sudden dips in the market. But like most systems, the international system of high-frequency trading is far from perfect. And even Frankfurt has had bouts of sudden volatility in recent months, brought on by fast-paced reactions to news. So it's only a matter of time before the next flash crash hits. Chipona Chimbelu, DW, Frankfurt.
Top HIV experts have been marking the 30th anniversary of the detection of the virus. Some of the top specialists in the field, including Professor Françoise Barré-Sinoussi, who in 1983 was responsible for detecting a retrovirus that later became known as HIV, gathered in Paris last week. Now, the gathering of experts was hosted by Barré-Sinoussi's own place of work, the Pasteur Institute, and one of the international guests was Australian HIV expert Professor Sharon Lewin, who heads the Infectious Diseases Unit at the Alfred Hospital in Melbourne. She told me that finding a cure for HIV was a tough ask, and yet scientists continue to look for one. So I asked Sharon Lewin first why we need a cure for HIV.
There are three main reasons why we need a cure. The first is that treatment isn't perfect. Treatment makes people much better and makes them live longer, but life expectancy is still not back to normal in a large number of patients, and there's ongoing toxicities and side effects from the treatments. That shouldn't underestimate how good the treatments are, but they're not perfect. I think the real issue is the cost of treating all the people who need it lifelong. So currently it's estimated there's 15 million people who need antiretroviral treatment, and we're treating about 60% of them. And we're struggling to even maintain that currently, let alone treatment for the next 40, 50, 60 years. I see a really strong economic argument for a cure. And if you actually speak to people that are infected, patients actually see this as a really high priority so that they can stop their drugs. I mean, what most patients really want is a sterilising cure to no longer be HIV positive. I'm not sure we're going to be able to achieve that, but I think there's a real patient desire for a cure as well.
When you say you're not sure you're going to be able to achieve that, are you really looking into far into the future, or are you talking about short term?
Well, many of us are talking about different types of cure. Normally, for most infectious diseases, if you get a sore throat, you go to your doctor, you get some antibiotics, and the infection's over, you don't worry about it. And most infections you can actually eliminate permanently. There are very few infections that you can't do that. And that's commonly called a sterilising cure. And that could be a tough ask in HIV. The other option is to achieve something which we now call a functional cure, which means the virus is still there, but at very low levels, and the patient's able to keep it under control in the absence of treatment. And that could still be a very good outcome, meaning that you wouldn't need to take tablets every day. It would significantly reduce cost. I think both are what people are thinking about or would like to try and achieve, functional cure or sterilising cure.
And you've been looking quite extensively at latency of the virus, so it's lying latent, mm-hmm. being dormant. Tell us, why is that so important?
HIV basically likes infecting a type of immune cell called the T cell, and it does different things in different T cells. So in some T cells, it replicates and divides. You put people on treatment and it wipes out that part of the virus. But it has this very clever trick. Actually, many viruses in the same family of HIV have this trick, which is called latency, where it gets into a resting cell, becomes part of the patient's DNA, and effectively lies dormant, but is still able to be infectious. And those, what we call infected sleeping cells or latently infected cells, are quite rare, but it's as if you've got these burning embers that are always there, and the minute you stop the drugs, the whole thing gets going again.
And you've found a way to reawaken these latent cells?
Yeah, so one, there's persistent virus in latently infected resting cells is the main reason why current treatments don't cure HIV, because once you stop the drugs, those resting cells wake up and bang, the whole thing gets going again. So we're very interested in seeing how we can get rid of those latently infected cells, and there might be different ways to do it. But one way that's being tested now is to wake up that virus so it becomes visible to the immune system, or by waking it up, the cell could possibly self-destruct, and you can actually wipe out those last few bits and pieces of virus that hang around.
But it strikes me as being slightly risky. Is there not a risk factor in waking up the virus?
Yeah, I mean, we're thinking this will work only in people that are on treatment. So they have to be on effective anti-HIV drugs, otherwise it doesn't make sense. So the idea is you wake up the virus, is released from that cell, and it's got nowhere to go because you're on anti-HIV drugs, and the anti-HIV drugs stop the virus from hopping into the next cell. So, yeah, when we just did this clinical trial of a drug that does exactly this, and we were quite concerned about the virus going crazy, and, of course, explained all that to our patients, because at the time we had no idea whether the virus would go crazy or you'd just tickle it. And as it turned out, the virus didn't go crazy, meaning we could, with the usual tests we use, we could only detect a smidge of virus in the blood in 3 out of the 20 patients, and it was at very low levels. So we know we could wake up the virus using very sensitive tests that look inside the cell, but the virus didn't go crazy. Are there other adverse events from using these medications? There are. These drugs that we're using currently are for cancer, so they're for people that have got a very serious life-threatening illness, and we know there are side effects from these drugs. Most of them are reversible, and we don't know really if there are any long-term consequences of taking this sort of medication for at least 2 weeks. We're going to watch the 20 patients very closely.
We were talking just before about the antiretrovirals and how many people do have access to them, and I think the access is increasing in sub-Saharan Africa. What do you see as the best development in sub-Saharan Africa, for instance, in African countries or in other areas in poorer nations, while your research continues? What needs to happen?
Our research in cure can't get in the way of access to treatment, because that's absolutely fundamental. Treatment works, treatment saves lives, treatment stops new infections. At the moment, we're treating 60% of people who need treatment, so we need definitely to do better. I think what's happened in Africa is incredible. I mean, back in 2000, there was no one on antivirals, and most of the community thought it'll be too hard, too expensive, too complicated. That was not the case. You know, there's now 11 million people on treatment in countries that have health systems where people thought wouldn't be able to support the complexity of anti-HIV drugs, but they've done brilliantly. So it's hard work and it needs a lot of investment and training and capacity building and ongoing investment. I think that's the real difficulty with treating HIV. It's not just a one-off starting treatment. It's starting a treatment program that's going to be there at the moment, will need to be there for forever to keep people on treatment forever. So access to treatment is a real top priority. Access to testing is key as well. And we now know that so many people don't even know they're infected. Once they get diagnosed, we lose many people to follow up to be put on treatment, and then we lose many people to follow up to stay on treatment. So we have a lot of work to do in many countries to strengthen those health systems, to find people, test them and keep them in care.
Professor Sharon Lewin, who heads the Infectious Diseases Unit at the Alfred Hospital in Melbourne. She also heads the Department of Infectious Diseases at Monash University. And you're listening to Spectrum with me, Zulfikar Abani, on DW. Online, we're at dw.de/spectrum. And you can, of course, always follow us on Twitter at @DW_SciTech. Indian scientists have developed a low-cost vaccine that could prevent a severe form of diarrhea caused by the rotavirus. At $1 per use or dose, the oral vaccine Rotavac is a fraction of the cost of existing rotavirus vaccines. It could go a long way to preventing severe diarrhea and dehydration, which claim the lives of tens of thousands of infants and young children in developing countries each year in Asia and Africa. Murali Krishnan reports from New Delhi.
The rotavirus kills almost 500,000 children under the age of 5 each year. India has the highest number of deaths. About 100,000 children die each year from severe diarrhea and dehydration caused by the virus. Neighboring Pakistan and in Africa, Nigeria suffer a combined 80,000 child deaths annually. Vaccines exist and there are two doses on the Indian market, but they're relatively expensive at about $18 per dose. So this new vaccine, at just $1 per dose, could save countless lives in low-resource countries. It was developed in a public-private partnership in India by pediatric scientist Dr. M.K. Bahn and an old friend and colleague from the U.S., Dr. Roger Glass, director of the Fogarty International Center. Their Phase 3 clinical trials involved 7,000 infants in three Indian states and showed the vaccine to be safe and effective, even in response to various strains. Dr. Bahn says the vaccine will be a boon for rural India.
Almost 40 to 50% of all severe diarrhea is due to rotavirus. It is now the predominant cause of diarrheal deaths, diarrheal hospitalizations. It's particularly important for us because diarrhea affects poor, and particularly the outcome is worse in them. And for most poor families and women, negotiating hospitals, negotiating doctors, you know, particularly in rural areas, is very, very complex.
His fellow researcher, Dr. Glass, explains that their work was spurred when they discovered a particular strain of rotavirus in newborn babies.
Normally, rotavirus doesn't infect newborns, but this strain did. So the early research together was to show that this infection caused a good immune response, absolutely necessary for a good vaccine. The children who were infected in the newborn ward were protected from subsequent severe disease. So this was a natural immunization that was asymptomatic in those newborns. And that was those observations that led us to develop this and consider this as a potentially very effective vaccine.
The World Health Organization recommends that rotavirus vaccines be included in all national immunization programs. But while the Indian government provides subsidized vaccines for polio, tuberculosis, diphtheria, tetanus, and hepatitis B, it does not include rotavirus vaccines. The two other internationally licensed rotavirus vaccines are available in more than 40 countries, but they remain out of reach for many people in developing countries. Rotavac is cheaper than these existing vaccines and an effective alternative. It is an oral vaccine and would be given to infants in a three-dose course at 6, 10, and 14 weeks of age. India's drug controller body is currently considering whether to approve it. Dr. Glass again.
We not only wanted to have a vaccine that was safe and effective, but we wanted to have a vaccine that was affordable and could be used in the public sector and public programs, because that's where it will reach everyone. There are vaccines licensed in India from the outside. They're quite expensive for the routine Indian, the poor Indian. This is a way to overcome that price hurdle and as a safe and effective vaccine. I think not only could it be helpful here in India, but in many of the developing countries, 90 million children born in low-income countries where most of the deaths occur.
A South Indian-based firm, Bharat Biotech, will offer Rotavac at $1 per dose. It plans to file for licensing in July. K. Vijay Raghavan is the secretary of the Indian government's Department of Biotechnology.
This will now go to the drug controller, who will take the matter into consideration, and we should make sure that we allow them to do this assessment fairly and correctly. India has an effective vaccination program, so the next step would be to take this through licensing to allow it to integrate into the vaccination program and make the largest possible impact. Once we make this impact, we will see all sorts of changes in our society in terms of how this disease affects people, whether it affects them less or differently, and so on and so forth.
If approved, Rotavac will become the first entirely new vaccine developed and approved in India in over 100 years. But there is still much to be done to test its efficacy while reaching out to newborns across the country. Unlike most clinical trials that take place in a hospital setting, in this case, researchers and doctors had to go out to the communities where they recruited appropriate volunteers and monitored their progress. Dr. Glass says this is just the start.
I feel like I'm at a commencement where we've graduated to have something that's effective, but the true impact will only be known in the next couple of years when this is rolled out in the communities of India and where we can actually measure and monitor an impact on child health.
For Dr. Bahn, the experience has given rise to hope that India is on the track to develop a homegrown pharmaceuticals industry.
It has given us tremendous experience through this global partnership to learn how to do these things from discovery to the end product. We have science, which is good. We have a generic industry, which is good. Not often had the privilege of trying to cover the whole value chain. And this, with the help of some wonderful global partners, was possible to achieve.
Doctors estimate that the entire project costs around $80 million, so its development was far cheaper than most other drugs too. And if all goes well, the vaccines would be available as early as the end of 2013. Murali Krishnan, DW, New Delhi.
Digital Europe, bringing the continent's tech scene to your ears.
The latest research suggests that bullying via social networking or other online sites is a serious problem among teenagers in the United Kingdom. Stuart Holdsworth met up with some young people who've decided to give up their time to help support those who've been left traumatised by how they've been treated on the web and to offer general help and support.
Cyberbullying affects many teens on a daily basis. It can take many forms, from sending email threats to spreading rumours about somebody on Facebook. In London, I visited the offices of the organisation Beat Bullying, where a group of young people decided to fight back and become cyber mentors, or, as they call them, Beat Bullying mentors. Stephen Hill is a senior officer at Beat Bullying, and he explains what they do.
We work with individuals and volunteers and partners across the country, all across the UK, to train up volunteers to become mentors. So we give them the skills, awareness, things around safeguarding and things like that, to make sure that they can give advice and benefit of their experience to young people online. And just really being there after the training as well, to give them the post-training support as well that they will need.
A recent study in the UK found about 30% of 14 to 18-year-olds have been abused over the web, and 90% of victims don't tell a parent or trusted adult about it. Many of those young people are turning to Beat Bullying.
We deal with young people that are facing very difficult situations online, rumour spreading, kind of name calling. A lot of the behaviours that we sometimes see offline can be manifested online as well. But also a lot of things around paranoia that's being built up about kind of gossip being spread. All of those sorts of behaviours are very much things that we deal with every day.
Bullying on the web means that the victim is available to their tormentors at any time of the day or night. They're only a post or a message away.
When you get home, you can receive something through your social network site. You can receive a text message or a prank call or any of those sorts of things. So we're really seeing bullying and sort of targeted behaviours infiltrating beyond the school ground now. And as I say, with the rise of digital technologies, we really want to support people by doing that, which is where our work really is rooted, because online technologies is a good thing. The internet is a great thing. It's a great tool. It's a great resource. It's about the use of the internet that we want to educate people about.
Erin Lee is a beat bullying mentor. All the mentors have had intensive face-to-face training to give them the skills and confidence to mentor online, but also offline in their school or community.
We give them our life experiences. We tell them our advice, how we dealt with it and how they could possibly deal with it. We advise them to speak to someone, a family member, a teacher, someone trusted, to try and get it out in the open to help them.
Erin says, most of all, she's there to lend an ear.
I really believe that we've saved a lot of lives. I mean, it's so hard. People go to school and they get bullied. They come home and they get bullied. But it's almost a safe haven for them to come to. So they know that we're there. If they've even just had a bad day, they can come and talk to us and tell us. And we're just there to offer them some advice, cheer them up, talk about anything they want.
Steve demonstrates how their website works. Okay, so visitors can chat online directly with the mentors.
Okay, so we can see who's currently online now and different ways that people can approach us for support as well. So they can request to talk to one of our mentors directly. They can speak to one of our counsellors. But if they're somebody that's a bit nervous maybe of speaking directly in private chat, they can leave us a message in the support lounge. Now, our support lounge is a forum environment where they can just leave their issue, leave the situation that they're facing, come back maybe a day or two later and read all the responses from our fantastic mentors, all the things that they can practically implement in their lives. So that we really are appealing to people that want to engage with us directly through the kind of instant messaging service, but also accepting that sometimes it's not the easiest thing to do. Here we've got one about some experiences that people have faced at school, but also we have kind of poems. We have all different ways that people want to manifest their feelings, talk to us. We make sure that we're there for them and they can do that.
And Erin, as a mentor, when do you find the time to be online?
Any time during the day, really. Sometimes when I'm at work, you go in at lunchtime if it's not very busy. You go in during the day. Evening's generally the busier time, just after school. If they've had an experience, they'll come online and talk to us.
And do you find that it creates a social environment? Forgetting the mentors for the moment, but taking everyone using the site, can they sort of like maybe post something and then they all engage with each other?
Absolutely. The social aspect of the site is also so important because that's where we're building up our social skills. And sometimes when you are experiencing bullying, having a tough time at school, sometimes that side of your life is lacking. You don't get the opportunity to engage in the social aspects.
So do you think there's a wider issue there in terms of helping people understand their actions online?
This is one of the key things that we work with, is to really get people to understand what it is that they are doing. There is no difference between your online life and your offline life. You have a life, and the decisions that you make when you're online are the decisions that you should make offline. If you'd seen it or somebody was doing it to you, would you feel upset, offended, attacked? If so, then we urge people not to do it. So there is very much a culture change that we want to see across society to really understand the implications of what happens with online behaviours.
Following its success in the UK, the charity is now looking to set up branches further afield.
Absolutely. We're taking our steps into Europe, so watch this space is probably what the best thing to say. We are very excited about this development, so keep looking out for us and we'll be making more noise across Europe.
In this technology-driven world of today, it's clear that learning how to stay cyber-safe is becoming as important as any other life skill. This is Stuart Holdsworth for DW in London.
Well, that's just about all from Spectrum on DW for now. Don't forget, you can always keep up with our stuff at dw.de/science. You can listen again or download the podcast at dw.de/spectrum. I'm Zulfa Karibani. Our studio tech was Christoph Korver. Hope you can make it next time. Till then, thanks for listening and bye for now.